Now, for my sources tonight, I'm going to focus on three main bodies of material. First, of course, the Quran. Second, sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. And third, sayings of the Imam Ali, the last of the righteous caliphs. As regards to what is happening here and now throughout the world in the Muslim community, I can't really comment on that because I don't have the information. And I suggest that nobody does, because a great deal of the relevant information is inherently inaccessible. It can't be found by researchers. It says in the Quran, at the end of time, one day, you will see the believing men and the believing women, their light streaming before them and at their right hands. Now, if you go to some place with an attitude, a hostile attitude, obviously you're not going to be able to see that light. So I can't rely on reports of very limited information without considering the fact that true harmony within homes is something that can only be perceived by the eye of harmony and the feeling of harmony. Now, to turn to the matrix or the basis of what I have to say tonight, first I think it's important to remember always that Islam is a whole. And so to understand the significance of any given part or any given aspect of Islam, it's essential to understand that part or that aspect in the context of the whole. And that means, that includes the idea of the overall purpose and meaning of life. So if we want to discuss the issue of the place of women and womanhood in Islam, we have to understand the Islamic idea of the purpose and meaning of life within which the purpose and function of the individual is enacted. Now, for the purposes of this discussion, let's visualize the mosque as the center of public life, and the home, in some sense an extension of the mosque, as the center of private life. Now, with that vision of life in mind, let's consult some verses from the Quran's chapter on light, where God is referred to as the light of the heavens and the earth. The book says, "The light is in houses which God has allowed to be raised, that the name of God be remembered there, where God is glorified in the mornings and the evenings, by people who are not diverted from remembrance of God by business or commerce. People who are not diverted by business or commerce from remembrance of God and persistence in prayer and giving of alms, as they fear a day on which hearts and eyes will be transformed, that God may reward them for the best of what they did." Then it concludes like this: "Do you not see that God is glorified by all beings in the heavens and the earth, even the birds on the wing? Each one knows its own mode of prayer and of praise, and God is aware of all that they do. For to God belongs the dominion of the heavens and the earth, and the journey is to God." Now that last line is the key. This is the meaning of life. The journey is to God. The contrast to this is also given in the Quran, where it says, "Vying for more and more diverts you until you go to the tombs." A reference to our end in the tombs has to do with our material strivings. So we have to realize, when we try to understand anything in the world of Islam, that the practice of remembrance of God changes the quality of cognition. There is a qualitative change in the mind, resulting, of course, in a change in the way you experience everything. And even if one doesn't participate in this remembrance, if one wants to take an intelligent standpoint toward Islam and the world of Islam, one has to take this factor into account, that the actual practice of remembrance of God, which in Islam is at least during the five daily prayers, but really is a matter of constant awareness. Now, because of this emphasis, for purposes of comparison, I won't compare Islamic ideas to contemporary Western secularism, because there really is no fair basis of comparison. What I'll do instead is make reference to other traditions which similarly emphasize the relationship, a harmonious relationship among the natural social and spiritual aspects of human life. Now, to understand the religious injunctions of Islam as well as any other system, we have to understand the basis or the reason for those injunctions. In modern times, where religion has been rejected by so many people, there is this assumption that religious injunctions are arbitrary dogma. But if we look at the expressed reasons, the expressed source and basis of injunctions in Islam, we can see the much better the logical pattern of the purpose, what these are supposed to accomplish in our lives. I think one of the best statements for understanding the basis of injunctions in the Quran is this, in the chapter on Rome. There is no changing the nature created by God. That is the right religion, but most of humanity does not know. Now that nature, the nature created by God, that means the primal nature, the original nature, the way we really are and should be. Now here where it says most of humanity does not know, well, most of humanity is conditioned by the environment. We're conditioned into acting in ways that is contrary to our real nature. And so that makes us ignorant of the religion that is actually built into us as our genuine God-created nature. The Quran also says, God wishes to lighten your burden, for the human was created frail. So here we see the purpose of injunctions being as a way of managing those aspects of ourselves that are vulnerable. So on the one hand, it's honoring, protecting, and enhancing the real nature, while at the same time protecting it against distortion, which in its vulnerability it can undergo in this earthly environment. Now, another difference between Islamic thought and contemporary secularism that needs to be briefly touched upon without going into a deep discussion of the Western ideas, political ideas of relevant issues. These are the questions of what it means to be dignified, what it means to be ennobled, what it means to be liberated. Now in Islam, all of these things, dignity, ennoblement, liberation, these are all God-centered or God-oriented rather than being self-centered or self-oriented. Here's an example from the sayings of Ali. Certainly the earth is not devoid of those who rise in honor of God for good reason, either openly and notably, or in fear and obscurity. They consider easy what seems hard to those who lead a life of comfort, and they take to what the ignorant are averse to. They are physically in the world, yet their spirits are suspended in the highest liberation. So this is a universal kind of liberation, not just for one group or another. And it's a spiritual liberation that's not defined by human laws. So when we try to understand what Islamic teachings regarding the freeing of the soul are all about, we have to understand this aspect of liberation. Okay, let me get into the substance of the talk. I'll start with the beginning of the chapter on women, appropriately enough. As almost every chapter of the Quran begins, it starts with invoking the name of God as the epitome of compassion and mercy. Now, in contemporary America, it's almost taken for granted that monotheism is somehow masculine, but the aspects of compassion and mercy are not really particularly masculine images, are they? And yet this is what starts all but one chapter of the Quran. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya Ayyuhannas, Annas, humanity, O humanity. It addresses us collectively. Ittaqoo Rabbakum, walladhi khalaqakum min nafsin wahidatin. Revere your Lord who created you from one self or from one soul. Now I'd like to look a little more closely at the specific words of the text. Uttaku rabbakum. This word, which I am glossing as revere, comes from a base root which originally means to protect. And in this form, we have it here, it means to protect yourself, to watch out. So that's why it's sometimes translated as to fear God. Now, if we look at the context in which this is spoken, watch out for God who created you, This refers to mindfulness of our origins. The word for creation here, khalaqa, has a derivative, a noun, khulq, which means nature or character. Now, the passage I cited earlier where it says that nature as God created is the right religion, the word there is fitra, which comes from fatara, to create. And fitra also, it means nature, like khulq means nature or character. So to be wary of God in respect of God being the creator means to preserve the true nature as God created it. Now, another derivative from that word for creation is khuliq, which means fit or suitable or apt, adequate or worthy. There's a good word. So here we have the sense of revering God by preserving the nature, the worthiness of the nature that God has created. الَّذِي خَلَقَكُمْ مِن نَفْسٍ وَاحِدَةٍ, who created you from one self. Now there alone is less than enough, that we're created from one self, or one soul. But let's look a little more closely at this word, which I'm glossing self or soul, in Arabic, nafs. Now in Arabic, for those who are not familiar with the language, words are built up out of basic roots, which are usually made of three consonants, and then elaborated so that from one root you can make up to 15 bases, and then those bases are elaborated into so many different verbal forms and all sorts of derivatives and whatnot, creating, in fact, with every root, an entire family, a universe almost, of meanings. Well, let's look at the meanings that we can generate from the root of nefs, meaning soul or self. Basically, as a word, nefs means soul or life for an animate being, a person, essence, nature, identity, or self. Now, in the first base, we have two verbs, nafusa and nafisa. This is quite interesting, actually. Nafusa means to be precious, to be valuable, to be priceless. This is the creation of God. But nafisa means to be stingy, to be sparing. Now, the second base tends to represent an intensification of the verb of the first base, or sometimes it makes an intransitive verb transitive. Well, what do we find in the second base? Nasasa, to cheer up, to comfort. This is, I envision this as the many selves, multiple selves, realizing their oneness, that we're made from one self. Now, the third and the sixth bases, the third base tends to make verbs which, if the verb of the first base represents a quality or a state, then the verb in the third base represents exertion of that quality or bringing that state to bear on something, okay? And the sixth base is like a reciprocal, a mutual type of action. Well, what do we find here? Nafasa and tanafasa. The third base, to compete, to strive, to desire. And the sixth base, to rival, to contend. So here we have a complete lesson, just in one word, one expression, that we're made from one nafs, from one self, one soul. And in that one self is priceless value, but also the capacity for selfishness. There is comfort and cheer in the mutual action of selves, but then there's also the possibility of contention and rivalry. So here is a beautiful illustration of the context of the two aspects of religious injunctions to enhance and preserve that which is precious, and to mitigate that which comes from selfishness, like contention and rivalry. Now let me continue with the original text here. So, the text goes on to say, وَخَلَقَ مِنْهَا زَوْجَهَا وَبَثَّ مِنْهُمَا رِجَالًا كَثِيرًا وَنِسَاءً. And God created from it, from that one soul, its mate, and then propagated from the two of them, many men and women. And there are a couple of points I find particularly interesting in this passage. First, of course, the idea of souls as mates. Souls as mates. The other is where it says, "Batha minhuma rijalan kathiran wa nisaa." That God propagated from the two mates, many men and women. In other words, propagation of the species is referred back to God. This is part of the whole Quranic atmosphere of mindfulness of God, but I find a little more significance in it, which to me is indicated by the word kathir, many, many men and women. There is a sense in the Quran of the earth already being populated. Now in more ancient messages, you find the command, be fruitful and multiply. You don't find that in the Quran. There's much more emphasis on dealing with the fact that all these people are here. I mean, of course, there is great respect for the procreative function, but one is reminded most of all of the ultimate origin of creation, and one is also reminded of the need to deal with creation tenderly and in a way that produces harmony. So we find a lot of emphasis in the Quran about taking care of orphans and getting along with neighbors, and a lot of emphasis on the different nations of the world getting to know each other. And it is in this light that I think the spiritual element of womanhood is able to come to the fore more clearly than we may see in earlier dispensations, because, in other words, the biological function, the procreative function with which we associate sexuality and gender, is not really so strongly emphasized in the Quran. Rather, the inner aspect of the relation between the man and the woman is what we find particularly important. Now this text goes on to say, وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ الَّذِي تَسَاءَلُونَ بِهِ وَالْأَرْحَامِ, and revere God by whom you ask of one another. تَسَاءَلُونَ, it's a contraction of تَتَسَاءَلُونَ, a sixth base verb which means mutuality. This is another key phrase, by whom you ask of one another. This is another key phrase within the context of which we have to understand Quranic injunctions regarding relationships. Namely that there is this mutuality of asking, and, or perhaps I should say but, it's all in the name of God. In other words, the human relationship is understood consciously in the home as having a higher purpose. It's not a matter of arriving at compromises between individual whims. Now the text, this section ends by saying, and revere the wombs. The word for wombs also means kinship, blood relationships, and obviously both meanings are appropriate. Something that's quite interesting in terms of the phrasing of the text is that, whereas in glossing it, I've repeated the verb, in the original text, the verb is only said once. In other words, the verb for revering has two objects in the same breath, God and the wombs. Now, this suggests to me something very special about what is being represented by this word, aham, the wombs, relationships. And we can see it right in the root, rahama, which means compassion or mercy. We can see not only, of course, in the invocation of the merciful, the divine mercy, constantly, but throughout the injunctions dealing with relationships, not only between men and women, but generally among people, this quality of mercy is and compassion is of utmost importance. And as we shall see, it is one aspect of womanhood, particularly in the capacity of motherhood, that is brought out very strongly in the Quran and the Islamic tradition as a sign of God, particularly, I would think, to remind us of this essential quality of mercy, which I would suggest is all the more essential in a world that is full, where you have many men and women, as the text says. So let me start by talking about mothers. As I said a moment ago in the Quran, human fecundity may be honored, of course, but it's not extolled. It's rather the social and spiritual aspects of motherhood that are more important. The Prophet is reported to have said, "Paradise lies at the feet of mothers." Now, I think this is a lot more than just a sentimental remark. First, I should say that Islam gives special honor to mothers, but also emphasizes the importance of fathers. Let me just quickly quote this verse, which talks about the obligation of every individual to care for his or her parents. The Quran says, "Lower the wing of humility to them both, mercifully, and say, 'My Lord, have mercy on them as they took care of me when I was small.'" And the Quran also says, here God speaks in the first person, "And we have made humankind responsible for their parents. Their mothers carry them, sapped and weakened, and their weaning takes 2 years. That you be thankful to me," to God that is, "and to your parents. The journey is to me." Now here again, the repetition of the ultimate purpose. The journey is to God. Be thankful to your parents. The journey is to me, is to God. Now here, of course, we have a recognition of the tremendous, tremendous labor, the work it is of motherhood, carrying the baby and nursing the baby. Right there, I mean, if that isn't a sign of mercy, I don't know what is. Now, it says their weaning takes 2 years. That's the legal outside limit. That you be thankful to God. That's a rather interesting statement, that children are nursed for 2 years so that they will be thankful to God, and to the parents, of course, but to God. Now, I think we all know that there's another kind of milk besides the physical milk. There's the milk of human kindness. And I think we all know what happens to people, what becomes of people who didn't get enough of the milk of human kindness when they were small. They grow up hungry and angry and dangerous, not thankful, not grateful people, and not loving people. So here I find something extremely profound and meaningful for society as a whole, the idea of bringing up children who are grateful to God, that is, children who are capable of being loving people, loving and giving people. So here again, to me anyway, it seems that the emphasis is not really so much on the physiological nursing, although of course that's taken for granted, but on the inner component of the nursing, the inner milk that makes giving people. As an aside, there is a technical legality of a prohibition against marrying someone who was suckled by the same wet nurse. I think that might actually have something to do with the recognition of the reality of the inner milk, because it's not easy to explain just in terms of the outer milk. Now, to focus a little bit more on this, the image of the mother as a sign of rahma, mercy, let me quote a saying of the Prophet on this subject. The Prophet said, "God rendered mercy into 100 parts, keeping 99 and sending one down to earth. By virtue of that one portion, creatures are merciful to one another, such that even the mare lifts her hooves away from her foal, fearing she may step on it." Well, right away we have an image of mothering to represent to us mercy on earth. And I see immediately three functions there. First of all, of course, the mercy in the mare does take care of the foal, actually takes care of the creature. Then the other beings, like the human beings, for example, in the surroundings, are affected by that relationship. We are reminded of mercy. Our hearts are somewhat melted, warmed by the mercy of the mare lifting her hooves from her foal. And that makes it easier for us to be merciful. to transmit mercy. So already the meaning is growing. And then, at the same time, you know, the Quran is always saying that the signs of God are signs for those who reflect on them. So when we reflect on the mare lifting her hooves from the foal, we ask ourselves, well, who taught her to do that? So in that way, we're reminded of God. We're reminded of divine mercy in the same way. So in a sense, motherhood, and I have to emphasize that this applies not only to those who are themselves mothers, but actually to all human beings. Motherhood is important not only in a linear way, not only in a linear way, but which in terms of propagation of a line of human beings, but also in a radiant way, in that the specific mood, shall we say, of motherhood, the mood of rahmah, of mercy, is radiant, and it affects us. It changes our hearts and our eyes. So in that sense, the idea of the mother and the woman in general is not so much biologically defined, but spiritually defined as this, a repository, and a radiant repository of the quality of compassion and mercy, which are fundamental to the development of a healthy human being, and naturally, by extension, to a healthy society. Now, let me call upon some witnesses from the side, some other traditions, to underscore this the spiritual or this this inner aspect of motherhood. One thing that's rather interesting in Taoism, where a great deal of study of natural science is combined with study of social and spiritual sciences, many of the metaphors, the instructive metaphors for meditative processes, are in fact metaphors from the processes of gestation and nursing. For example, there's an exercise called inner listening, and the standard image is of a mother hen listening to her eggs. And the belief is that the focus of attention is actually able to convey energy. There's also the image of the male becoming pregnant, and sometimes you can see pictures of a man with a baby in his belly. And these are representations of the kind of moment-to-moment, very intimate, very intense inwardness and concentration that is naturally part of the process of carrying a baby and nursing a baby. And if we think in Islamic terms of real nature, being itself, real religion, we have to then believe that this faculty of this incredible patience and punctilious awareness is a natural inherent gift of womanhood. And in terms of literal relations with women, therefore, in this tradition, the reverence for the woman is connected not only with the function of compassion, but also with it's connected to this power of concentration, which the men try to imitate. I think actually that's one reason why a lot of meditation texts are written for men. It's not simply because of bias in the societies of the time, but because the men actually needed more work on developing that type of consciousness. Now let me read a passage from a Buddhist scripture which illustrates this principle. This is a passage about a pilgrim whose name is Sudana, which means good stuff, the stuff of goodness, who goes to visit the mother of Buddha, who is Maya, which means magic. And in this story, Maya, the mother of Buddha, represents, is the prototype of motherhood, but also a prototype of womanhood. Then Sudana, emptied of notions of the forms of all beings, penetrating the minds of other beings, saw Lady Maya in the minds of all beings, her virtue sustaining all beings. Now, to me, this is like the idea of the inward milk, the milk of human kindness, which actually makes us human, if we got it in time, that is. Her virtue sustaining all beings, her body an accumulation of the virtues of all knowledge. Here's the image of the mother as the first teacher. Now, the in that inner milk is more than just mercy. She was engaged in non-discriminatory, perfect giving, impartial toward all beings, having united all beings in the fellowship of universal compassion. She had set out to actualize the virtues of all enlightened ones. She had entered the ocean of all ways of tolerance. Her mind was expanded with the flood of energy of all knowledge. She was indefatigable in clarification of all spheres of truth. She was adept in meditation on the essence of all things. Her mind was accomplished in all branches of meditation. She was engaged in all branches of meditation without confusion, and had perceived the unique sphere of meditation of those who arrive at being as is. She was intent on various meditations to evaporate the ocean of afflictions of all beings. She knew how to analyze the teachings of all the enlightened, and she had the wisdom to consider all the designs of reality. Now, I like this image of mothering because you see, of course, there's lots of meditative aspects to it, but it's all supported by knowledge as well. The ingredients of the milk include knowledge and understanding, as well as that this basic feeling of warmth and compassion and sympathy. Now, let me turn to the subject of work. And first, it should be noted that in the context of Islam, work means action according to faith, not just making a living. And the Quran says, in the words of God, "I do not suffer to be lost the work of any worker among you, male or female." Now, there are many cases in the Quran where everything is obviously spoken universally, but then there are some times when it does stop and mention male and female to make sure that you get the picture that it's talking about both of us. Now, here's another interesting section on work from the Quran. It says, "Don't wish for what God has given more to some than others. For men there is a portion of what they have earned, and for women there is a portion of what they have earned. And ask of God from the bounty of God, for God knows all things." Now it says, don't wish for what others have more than you. I think this means to appreciate your own and everybody's talents as individual and unique. There's a beautiful saying from Imam Ali: "The worth of each individual is what one does well. The worth of each individual is what one does well." Now, it goes on to say that there's a portion for men from what they've earned and a portion for women from what they've earned. And this is one of those areas, there's quite a few interesting areas in the Quran where it doesn't specify what that portion is. And I think this is one reason why the Quran is constantly telling us to think. And it makes us do so, too. That's one of the beauties of it. Well, let's think about this. The portion for men and the portion for women. Well, within the context of Islam, a man is expected to support the woman. So when we think about portions of earnings, one thing we have to think about is the difference between obligated income and discretionary income. In other words, income that is already under obligation and income that you're free to do whatever you want with. If you look at it in that way, money is not the value. And the value of the work can't be determined in a simplistic money formula, because the value of money itself differs according to how obligated it is. But nevertheless, clearly, the right of gainful employment for men and women is recognized in the Quran. Now, this passage that says, "Ask of God from the bounty of God," is kind of interesting. How do we value work? What are the satisfactions in work? It's easy to assume that when it talks about the bounty of God, it's talking about material things. But actually, everything is the bounty of God, isn't it? So, to me, this suggests that we also should think about the immaterial satisfactions in work when we're thinking about the overall economic structure. Do you think about both the material and the immaterial satisfactions? Now, in this case, for example, if a man is obliged to support his family, then logically he has a somewhat less leeway to to seek immaterial satisfactions, because first he's got to take care of the material income. So this is why I think the Quran says that there is a portion for each, without saying in this case what the portion is, because there are many factors to be considered. And indeed, the last line says, God knows all things. Now to me, in reference to your asking of God, it speaks of God as knowing all things. So to me, this suggests that in making these assessments, one should consider all things, consider the whole context when we think about what the blessings and satisfactions of work are. Then, of course, we have to think about the general value of work and how we think of its value. Again, to quote the Imam Ali, there is the worker of work in the world for the world, who is preoccupied by work and distracted from ultimate destiny. Then there is the worker of work in the world for what is after it. Now, the Imam goes on to say that the latter type, the worker of work in the world for what is after the world, actually gets the satisfactions of the world as well, and so becomes, as he says, master of the two houses. So by not being frantic about material things, but working as an expression of our God-given nature, gives us two satisfactions, gives us an inner satisfaction and an outward satisfaction. Then we also have the chapter on night, which was read earlier, which begins, by the night when it is dark, by the day when it is light, and the creation of male and female, your endeavors are surely diverse. As for those who give and are conscientious and believe in good and right, we will facilitate ease for them. As for those who are stingy and complacently satiated and repudiate good and right, we will facilitate hardship for them. So to me, this means that the real distinction here is between these two, those who give and those who are stingy, is one way they're described here. The real critical distinction is not the type of work you do. It says surely your endeavors are diverse. What the question of what makes them worthy or not is the thing to look at. Now it says in the text, guidance is up to us, and the hereafter and this world are ours. This refers to God. Again, this is the whole context of the work, that it's not, the world doesn't belong to us human beings. So their wealth does not profit them when they fall, as it says. So by this we have to understand that we have to consider that the effect on our character of the work that we're doing and the way that we're doing the work, whether we are male or female. Now this is going to go on for a while, so I'm going to have an intermission. The last thing I'll talk about right now is the subject of menstruation, which is one of the issues that women have to deal with. It is mentioned in the Quran in a rather simple way, actually. In reference to menstruation, the Quran simply says, huwa adha, which in English means it hurts. And the verb on the first base where this word comes from, adha, is adhiya, which means to be hurt. It's an intransitive verb. So, in other words, the Quran makes reference to the discomfort of the woman. And if you look carefully at all of the injunctions regarding menstruation, which are very few and uncomplicated actually, all of them have to do with providing for alleviation, privacy, and the comfort of the woman. Now there's a further dimension, the inner dimension. Menstruation is a kind of cleansing process, sort of between the external and the internal, but it has both external and internal dimensions. And we can note that the verb which is used for external cleanliness in this regard is exactly the same as the verb that's used for internal cleanliness, purity, immaculate heart and soul. Now we can find a clue to this this function, shall we say, or this approach to menstruation in a saying from Imam Ali, spoken to a friend who was ill, and the connection is the idea of menstruation as an indisposition. May God make what you have suffered a means of diminishing your sins, for there is no reward in sickness, but it diminishes sins and removes them, as it were like falling leaves. There is only reward in the speech of the tongue, and the work of the hands and feet. And yet God, the glorified, admits to paradise anyone at will for truthfulness of intention and goodness of innermost consciousness. So here's a hint for a positive function in disposition, not only this particular one, but of any kind, the inward use of indisposition to purify the heart. Now, I understand that in contemporary society there, and with the economic structure that we have, there may be some objections to this type of attitude, but if we think in contemplative terms, and we think of life as a process of remembrance of God, then certainly it would behoove us to consider providing for the security of all of those operations that involve our purification of ourselves and our remembrance of God. Well, I'll close the discussion of menstruation there. I'm sorry if I've invaded any privacy, but this is an area where I feel, quite frankly, that in the modern world, insult is added to injury, and that if we were a more contemplative people, we could approach it in a way that would be more emotionally satisfying, I think, and also far more spiritually satisfying. And I think that the benefits of this regular renewal, shall we say, and clarification certainly would naturally be, again, radiant, effusive, and benefit the whole community. And with that, I will, why don't we take 10 minutes recess, and then when we return, I will talk about marriage, sexuality, and conviviality.